Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, a program where we teach you how to think, not just what to think. Hello, I'm Ken Samples, and I'm joined by my colleague and friend Dave Rogstad, who is a physicist at Reasons to Believe. Our regular co-host Joe Aguirre is away today, and hopefully will be back with us next time. Dave, I have a topic that I think a lot of our listeners is going to be interested in, and that is I want to talk a little bit about the explanatory power and scope of two particular worldviews. One of the worldviews, of course, is the secular worldview of naturalism, and the other is the religious worldview of Christian theism. And I'm kind of going to rely a little bit upon you to talk to us about the kind of science foundation here as we kind of share and help people to think about these particular worldviews.
Absolutely.
Well, let me say something about this kind of reasoning that we're going to kind of engage in. Many times on our program, I have talked about what we call abductive reasoning. And what I find interesting about abductive reasoning is it is particularly focused on how do we provide the best explanation for reality. So abductive reasoning, instead of being deductive or inductive, it talks about what is the most plausible explanation for why the world is the way it is, or why certain phenomena in the world are the way they are. And of course, you know, this is different. It is different. Again, it doesn't have certainty. It doesn't track on the rail with probability. It reflects this idea of plausibility. But it is also, I think, evaluated a little bit differently. You know, we evaluate an explanatory theory largely on the level of, you know, how well does it explain reality? That we call that explanatory power. And then how much of reality, its scope, explanatory scope, how much of reality is it able to explain? And Dave, I tend to think that this is a very interesting way of approaching Christianity. I mean, you have people who take very different views about apologetic methodology. You have Christian thinkers who present arguments for God's existence in deductive arguments. You have other people who present probability arguments for, you know, design or for the resurrection of Jesus. I find this to be a very interesting thing. And I, you know, I was thinking one day, if somebody asked me, well, what is ultimately the reason why you are a Christian, why you believe in God, why you believe in Christianity? I think, Dave, I would probably say, because I think that the Christian world and life view can explain reality in a very powerful and convincing way. It explains why the world is the way it is, both the universe having a beginning, being fine-tuned, but yet it also says something about my life, that I am an exceptional human being as a species, but I am broken and fallen. It also says something about, I think, ethics and abstractions and beauty. And maybe most importantly, I've been recently reading through the Gospels, and I'm at this present time, I'm reading through the Gospel of Mark. And I think Jesus is the most extraordinary and consequential person who ever existed on planet Earth. And I think that the Christian worldview provides an adequate explanation for his life. So when I think about why I am a Christian, I kind of think in terms of kind of what is the best explanation. What's your take on that, Dave? Are you along that line, or do you have a different view?
No, I think that the thing that really spoke to me, and in fact, I've commented in the past how I've written up my testimony, kind of a story, a two-page story of what happened to me, how I grew up and was taught certain things and then kind of violated those things. And one of the things that I say in there that as how I would answer this question is that what I found was that Christianity, and in particular the Bible, how it revealed who I am at my core, this brokenness mm-hmm. that exists within my core. And it was very, it really exposed me for who I really was at root, and I couldn't get away from it. And it brought conviction. You know, most people, when they look at their life, they always have some kind of excuse or rationale for the way that they behave. And I think a murderer or a bank robber, you know, he can't live with the tension that exists within his being unless he has some explanation for it. And I think that he has some rationale, some excuse for why what he's doing is justified. Mm-hmm. But when that's all stripped away, when all of those justifications are stripped away and you're left holding the bag, as it were, what do you do? And that's when you come to the place of realizing you're desperately in need of a savior.
Yeah.
And that's the key thing that happened to me at a certain point in my life. Now, if it was only that, then we would be left in trouble if there weren't also, in addition, historical reasons, scientific reasons, all these other kinds of apologetic reasons for why our faith makes sense and fits. And as you put it in this abductive way, gives an explanation with great scope. But the fundamental thing for me at that point in my life was how it spoke about me in within my own heart.
Yeah, that's really great, because even though the ideas I want to talk about here in just a few minutes relate more to, you know, the world, the cosmos, the right. kind of the formal human situation, you're touching upon other things that I think would very much fit in this kind of context, that, you know, we have the moral, spiritual, call it existential human condition. And I think Christianity is able to explain well why human beings are what Pascal calls an enigma of greatness and wretchedness.
I
think that RTB is right on the money when we talk about humans being an exceptional species. And of course, we ground that in the biblical idea that we're made in the image of God. So humans are able to do mathematics, they're able to do science, they're able to do philosophy, they engage in art. Humans are smarter, is the way some scientists would put it, or human beings have boundaries that other species on the planet are very limited in. But yet you note, and I think rightfully so, Dave, that on a personal level, the reason why I'm a Christian is because I'm a fallen sinner and I need a savior. And Jesus offers forgiveness of sin, that his life, death, and resurrection have made me right with God. And he loves the world. And that message of redemption is found, you know, uniquely in Christ. And so those moral, spiritual, and existential elements could also be placed within this explanatory medium where we say, look, not only does the Christian worldview do a pretty good job of explaining why the cosmos is the way it is, but then it also does a great job of explaining why the microcosm of my life is the way it is. That there is, again, this greatness and wretchedness that Christianity is able to explain. I, of course, Dave, note that Hugh Ross has said that he thinks that human beings, now I'm speaking in terms of our anthropology, kind of the human condition, Hugh has shared with me that he thinks that humans are both better and worse than naturalistic evolution would have likely been able to produce. That humans are exceptional and are way above, yet there also seems to be a fallenness that is not merely biological. That is, our brokenness is seemingly different than just, evolution is imperfect, and so you have imperfect people. I guess to think about Pascal, I think Pascal would say we use our greatness in our wretchedness. We use these incredible abilities of mind and reason and rationality sometimes to make us better bank robbers or, better people at committing war crimes.
Right.
And, in fact, there's a show I want to do in the future, kind of giving a little appetite to our listeners. I want to do a show in the future, Dave, about the fact that Germany in the 1930s was considered by many people to be the most educated culture ever.
Mm.
And yet all of that education and all of those people with graduate degrees and culture and civilization didn't stop the Nazi movement toward genocide. So that'll be a topic we'll pick up.
Yeah.
Well, let's then kind of look at this idea of comparing naturalism and theism. And we've done a little bit of that, Dave, with your kind of personal assessment of the moral, spiritual kinds of issues. But I want to talk a little bit more about the world in which we live in. And I want to ask the question, which of the two worldviews, naturalism and theism, which of those two worldviews have the best explanatory power? And I want to raise this question, Dave. You've heard people say, and it's usually skeptics, it's usually secular people who make this charge against religion. I know Richard Dawkins has made the statement. Kind of leading atheists have said something similar. They say that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Yes, I've heard that.
I want our listeners to keep that in mind as we kind of delve into naturalism. That is it true that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? And I guess I want to ask the question at the outset, who has the most to explain? Is it naturalism or theism? So keep that in your mind. I want to come back to that a little bit later, Dave. But I want to talk a little bit about naturalism. Dave, I have a little chart that I've used in one or two of my books, and I'm referring to that now. And I start kind of giving an explanation, and here's naturalism. I would argue that naturalism would say that life, that is life on this planet, ultimately that life comes from non-life. And again, the backdrop for all of this is, if naturalism is true, that the natural, material, physical world is all there is, there's no supernatural involved in the world. There's no tripersonal spiritual being called God. Humans have no souls. There are no angels. So there's only the natural. There's only the material physical world. Now, we may not know how extensive naturalism is. That is, there are people who make claims about, you know, a multiverse or an ensemble of universes. But I think even if you adopt something like that, Dave, it's still kind of naturalism. It's still the material physical right. world is all there is. There really is no supernatural. So given that context in which there's no mind behind the universe, there's no creator, there's no director, there's no engineer, there's no programmer, there's no mind behind the universe. And so whatever we get is kind of coughed up by evolution. Well, I think, you know, whenever life began on planet Earth, however long life has existed on planet Earth, there was a time on planet Earth, and I would imagine throughout the universe, there was a time where there was no life at all. So where does life come from? Not just human life, but animal life, all the way down to, you know, microbial life, insects. Where does life come from? It seems to me, Dave, given naturalism, on naturalism, life comes from non-life. It's just a remarkable thing that the natural world was able to produce life. But I can go further as we kind of talk about these things. Now I could say something about persons. You know, a person is an individual who has a mind, will, and emotions. You know, they can think about things. They can, they have an awareness of the self. All of these kind of classical definitions of a person. Well, I think given naturalism, then personhood or persons would have come into existence somehow from the impersonal.
Yeah.
Before
you move to that personal, just to go back to that life from non-life.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a little more comment on that. In a sense, life is an extraordinary thing. And if we follow the mantra that you mentioned at the beginning there, extraordinary things require extraordinary explanations. And it just seems to me that when we look at just life now, not extending to this personal life, which you started to talk about, just look at the basic life. All the evidence seems to point to that the initial origin of life on the Earth was very complex. Mm. It wasn't just extremely simple, highly probable. It was from the very beginning, extremely improbable. Mm-hmm. And in order to somehow, well, for the moment, no one has an explanation for the origin of life. There's lots of suggestions, but no one can claim that they have the answer for how life originated. And, you know, one, of course, sort of extreme view is that the multiverse, there are so many universes out there that one of them, even though it's highly improbable, one of them is going to have life, and we happen to live in the one that has life. But that seems to me to be an extraordinary explanation.
Yeah.
Way outside the scope or the things that we would want to consider as the explanation for why life is present. So it's just all of these things that just on that one subject alone pile up against the idea that life is a possible outcome of a naturalistic universe.
So this origin of life, it's presently inexplicable by the scientific enterprise. We don't know how life came to be.
That's right.
We don't have a thoroughgoing natural explanation, but there it's also that this is complex life. It's not merely just kind of a gradual movement from simple to more complex. I mean, I've heard Fazarana and others talk about the Cambrian explosion, where very early you have a very complicated life, and which the very, doesn't
the
doesn't
very seem origin, to... yeah, the very the earliest forms of life that we have been able to gain information about from rocks and, you know, doing paleontology, is that it's complex.
Well, let me now go back to our listeners here for a moment. Remember, I ask you to keep in mind this claim, this kind of mantra that is often given by secular people, a kind of a charge made by secularists to religious people, namely that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Dave, is life from non-life an extraordinary thing?
Absolutely.
And is not a ensemble, a world ensemble or a multiverse, is that not an extraordinary claim?
To me, it seems to me, it's sort of a, you know, what can we come up with to somehow explain this extraordinary origin of life?
And thus, as our listeners, as we think about these, you know, side-by-side examples of naturalism and theism, I want our listeners to be thinking along the lines, does naturalism make extraordinary claims in which they don't give us extraordinary evidence? I mean,
yes.
I mean, the multiverse is, I think, an extraordinary claim, but you know, there are people like Ellis and Paul Davies who say, well, we can't know if those universes are there. We don't have direct empirical data. We can postulate and speculate, but you know, if secular people are going to bring this claim that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, well, doesn't naturalism have a lot of extraordinary claims? And do they have,
for which they fall short in extraordinary explanations?
Yeah. The claims are extraordinary. The evidence is much more challenging. Well, let me move to a second element in this, in the naturalism context, that persons come from the impersonal. Again, people, we think of people as having mind, will, and emotion. We think of people as having self-awareness. Even in the abortion debate, there are people who talk about, well, we know it's human life, but is it really a person? Well, we can raise this question that in a naturalistic context, there was a time on planet Earth in which there were no persons. And then there were persons. So did the personal in a naturalist context come from the impersonal? And I mean, we talk about life, which is very complicated, Dave. How much above that is when we start talking about rational human life?
Yes.
I mean, we're you know, when I go hiking and I look at the ants and, you know, the beetles, I wonder what's going on in the mind of, if those creatures have minds, what's going on in those minds, you know? And I wonder, do ants and beetles kind of look up at me and say, what the heck's going on in the mind of Ken Samples? Well, these are questions. And again, we've talked about life and persons, but we could also talk about minds. In a naturalist context, we have minds that I guess came from a non-mind. And if I continue down this cycle, reason, like logic and rationality and mathematics and deduction, induction, abduction, all of these kind of rational components that we engage in, I think I'm being fair by saying that there was a time, if you adopt the naturalist worldview, in which there was no reason, and reason came from the non-rational. That is, again, there's no mind behind all this, Dave. And correct me, maybe I'm being simplistic and inaccurate. Please correct me, because I'm not a scientist. But I always thought that that an effect cannot be greater than the cause. I thought that that was part of how we think about these things. But it, I mean, if life comes from non-life and persons from the impersonal and minds from the mindless and reasons from the non-rational, it seems that the effect is exponentially greater than the cause.
All right, you know, it's funny you bring that up that way. It almost seems like in the scientific realm that they would have said, yes, the effect, the cause is always greater than the effect. But now they're turning around and saying, well, maybe that's not true. Maybe there really is, because they can't explain all of these very, very difficult effects here, that maybe the effect can be greater than the cause.
Yeah.
Maybe there is something. It reminds me of that story of a psychologist talking to a person who is convinced that they're dead. And the psychologist is trying to convince the person that they're not dead. And so then he asks some of the questions, do dead people bleed? And the guy says, no, a dead person doesn't bleed. So then he stabs him with his knife and he's bleeding. And the patient looks at his arm and he says, by George, I guess dead people do bleed.
That's wonderful. Yeah, well, again, I want to draw our attention here to the people listening to this podcast that, we're talking about, again, we're talking about abductive reasoning. What is the best explanation for the world in which we live, for our human condition? You know, human beings have a brain, mind. We're not absolutely sure the exact relationship between the brain and the mind. The naturalist would tell us that somehow the brain evolved to a place where the mind emerged. So you have kind of an emergent situation. But that means something that can't think becomes something that can think. And I think that, again, that question of extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Now, I'll tell you more about that. I mean, one of the ways that I have responded to that previously is I've questioned it. Do extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? For example, Dave, I'm convinced that Lee Harvey Oswald assassinated President Kennedy, and I think it's highly probable he didn't have any help. So I don't adopt a conspiracy theory, but I think the way you would prove that is if Ruby had not killed Oswald and he would have gone to trial. Now I think it's an extraordinary thing that a single person could have, you know, somebody as inconsequential as Oswald to kill somebody as consequential as the leader of the free world, John F. Kennedy. That's kind of an extraordinary thing that he pulled that off, even with Secret Service and protection of the Dallas police. Kind of an extraordinary thing that the president could be murdered. But I think the evidence that you would present for Oswald doing that, it wouldn't be all that different than other murder trials. They would look to the rifle and, hey, do you have a palm print on the rifle? Was this Mannlicher Carcano purchased by Oswald? And did he have access to the book depository building? Was there anybody with him when the motorcade, passed? Did he flee? Did he kill an officer trying to get away? That is, the way I've responded to this previously is to question whether extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. I think it's an extraordinary claim that somebody could have said Oswald did this. And of course, Dave, this is what all the conspiratorial people say. How is it possible that one man could have pulled all of this off?
Right.
Well, I think the way you would go about proving it is actually with ordinary evidence, yeah. Fingerprints, eyewitness testimony. So in the past, I have said, I don't know that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, but now I'm maybe moving to another point of view and saying, okay, well, if let's adopt the idea that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. What does that do for naturalism?
That's right.
Can life come from non-life? Can persons come from the impersonal? Can minds, do they come from the mindless? I mean, does the human capacity to reason, I mean, my goodness, Dave, somebody like Newton, and from what I understand, Isaac Newton was sheltering from the bubonic plague. And that was part of the time he's in his study thinking about gravity and thinking about his scientific ideas, which again tells you human beings are extraordinary. You know, they can be under very difficult conditions and yet come up with amazing things. And then, you know, then Albert Einstein, I've mentioned to you, Dave, I took one physics class, and I have to tell you that you got a PhD in physics. That's hard for me to get my mind around.
Yeah, me too.
It was just such a challenging topic. I thought, my goodness, what kind of effort would you have to put in to get a PhD from Caltech in physics? I mean, I take my hat off to you, because the mathematical background that you need to then maneuver your way through the different ideas in physics, you know, it's one of the things I appreciate about you being a person of accomplishment. But, you know, for Einstein to come up with a mathematical equation that could then be tested and be shown to be a match to physical phenomena, I mean, that's the thing that hit me in my physics class. It was like, well, I understand why mathematics works given a theistic background, but wow, if there's no God and no mind, that a non-mind would produce minds that are able to use mathematics, that seems like an extraordinary claim. Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on. We talk about life from non-life, persons from the impersonal, minds from the mindless, reason from the non-rational. Let me add a couple more here as we think about the natural world. How about information without a sender? Dave, when I look at DNA, it blows my mind. I was watching a program just the other day where the police department in one of the cities here in California was able to capture the murderer, the mass murderer, the Golden State Killer, because they were able to use DNA in some context and were able to trace it back to him. You know, they had partial DNA on him, and they were able to do a search and find the family and then track it down to him. They were, by the way, hoping to do that with the Zodiac Killer as well, kind of solve these crimes by DNA matches. Well, how does information come without an information sender? How do we have a code from a non-programmer? I mean, I've made the simple analogy that if I were walking on a beach and I saw SOS written in the sand, would I think that wind and waves have caused the SOS, or would I think, wow, maybe somebody is in distress? Mm. You know, SOS is the indication that a person needs help. I mean, that's a very minor thing to then compare to the DNA code. How does information and a code come from someone or something that is not personal, that is not rational? I don't know, Dave, do they think that DNA is just part of the stuff that was there from the beginning? Am I wrong to say that this seems to call out for a personal, rational explanation that extends beyond naturalism?
I confess that I have not understood how these people can say that this information just somehow came into being. It certainly wasn't there in the beginning in a naturalistic world. And that information, they are convinced that this mechanism, once life was started, of course, they have to assume that life began, and then the mutations, some of those mutations were favorable, and survival of the fittest meant those mutations remained. But whenever you look at any kind of mutation, the largest fraction of them are negative and cause death for this life-carrying entity rather than improve it. So it's in the face of extremely highly improbable events that this mechanism somehow, in their view, can produce these forms of information, which is, you know, an improved life form. And I don't really understand how they can just ignore that.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is what we call confirmation bias. And again, it's the idea that there's a tendency on human beings to look at evidence and gravitate toward things that confirm their view and to conveniently ignore things that go against their view. And I'm aware that there is this confirmation bias, and to try to combat it, I try to say, well, what is the best explanation on the other side? I try to expose myself to people who think differently than I do. But Dave, I don't know that I'm committing confirmation bias by saying that naturalism has a lot of explaining to do and that they are making extraordinary claims and they don't seem to have extraordinary evidence. I remember I was giving a talk at a neuroscience conference, and I was presenting the case for consciousness coming from God. And, you know, they just kind of casually talk, well, hey, you know, the brain just reached a level of evolution and poof, the mind was emerged. And I was thinking, and your evidence for that is what? It seems to me that these are extraordinary claims because there's no mind, there's no life, there's no person, there's no mind, there's no reason, there's no information, there's no code in terms of the cause. But then the effect has life, person, mind, reason, information, and code. Do you see my point?
Absolutely.
It seems that, I try to understand how people think and how they reason. I guess if you are a biologist, if you are a physicist, a neuroscientist, maybe you specialize in these particular fields, and maybe you're not asking what many people might say the philosophical question. That is, you're more interested in the components of life or the components of a code and not asking, well, the big picture, where did all this come from? Why is it here? And am I advocating an extraordinary claim when I don't have extraordinary evidence? Well, that's something I want you to think about as you're listening to our program. Now, Dave, any other thing you want to say about naturalism before I shift to the other side of the column and talk about a Christian theistic explanation?
No, go ahead.
Well, again, I put these on columns. This is from a, some of this is in a couple of my books that I'll tell you about later when we kind of wrap everything up. But again, we have these categories of life, personhood, minds, reason, information, and code. So now I want to shift to theism, or particularly Christian theism or biblical theism, whatever you're comfortable with there. And of course, there we have a God who created the world, ex nihilo. So from a Christian theistic point of view, there's only the triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, one in essence, three in personhood. And this God creates everything from nothing, meaning that he calls that which does not exist into existence. He doesn't use any pre-existent or previously used material. God speaks or calls, and the universe emerges. And this is, again, a biblical doctrine. I think we see this in Genesis 1:1, and the heavens are created, heaven and earth are created by God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But I see it as well in the book of Hebrews. I see it in the book of Romans and Colossians. And so God is a infinite, eternal being. And he has all of these qualities. God is life. It's not that God just has life and creates life. God is life. God is persons. God is I mean, one way you could describe God as an invisible mind. You could also say that God is reason, flows from God's nature. Mathematics flows from God's nature, and thus he is the source, the ground for information and code. So that's a very different backdrop than naturalism, where you have no mind, you have no persons, you have no guiding force, at least not a personal, rational, mindful force. But in theism, you do. And of course, there are other religions that are theistic other than just Christianity. You know, you have the Middle Eastern monotheistic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. You also have Zoroastrianism, and then you have a variety of other groups that claim some association with it. But Dave, I think it would be fair to say that in a Christian context, life comes from ultimate life. The reason why you have, as you read the book of Genesis, the reason you have such different varieties of life here on planet Earth is that God is the ground and source of life, and then he's created all of this other finite life, the animals, the insects, and then ultimately human beings that are made in his image, a special creation of God. But that life itself, and wherever that life might be in the universe other than on planet Earth, you know, maybe it's just microbial life, or I don't know, maybe we could speculate about extraterrestrial life, but it seems to me that life comes from ultimate life. So in a theistic context, in a biblical context, the origin is greater than the effect. The cause is greater than the effect. The cause is ultimate life. The effect is finite life. And I think that pattern would continue, that persons in the world who have the capacity to think and to reason, have mind, will, and emotion, have some sense of self-reflection, can think about things, whatever that is, consciousness, personhood, that from a biblical point of view, a Christian point of view, the persons come from the superpersonal. And what I mean by that is that when we get to God, God is not merely personal, he's personal and more, he's tri-personal. He's three persons rather than one independent person. And so again, in a biblical, theistic, historic Christian context, life and personhood, the cause is exponentially greater than the effect. Human minds, whatever consciousness the animals have, that's finite. That's finite life, that's finite personhood that came from a source and a ground that is unlimited and boundless. And again, I can move down the list, minds from the ultimate mind. Why do human beings have minds? Well, in a biblical Christian context, it's because God is the ultimate mind and he creates creatures that are kind of like him. They are finite and temporal, yet they have qualities and characteristics that reflect that mindfulness. And I mean, even in the attempt to think about artificial intelligence, Dave, we have people in neuroscience, we have people in areas of technology where people are actually trying to duplicate life in the lab or minds, artificial minds that mimic or maybe even, and of course, the ideal goal would be to have strong artificial intelligence where the mind would actually have an independent nature. According to Stephen Hawking and others, that strong artificial mind might decide to get rid of us if it's allowed to. You can see where I'm going. Where does reason come from? Why do human beings have the capacity to do math and science and logic? Well, because the God who created them possesses all of those qualities in a boundless, infinite sense. And so he creates creatures that reflect his rational qualities. Information, unlike naturalism, where it comes without a sender, information comes from a sender, and the code comes from a personal programmer. The reason why DNA is this extraordinary source for knowledge and information is because it was implanted by a creator. Dave, what do you think about this type of reasoning? I mean, I have thought to myself, if I were going to give a debate tomorrow with an atheist to a group of people, I might, instead of talking about the cosmological, teleological, and moral argument, or instead of necessarily talking about evidence for the resurrection, although I might use a combination thereof, I might just say, hey, well, wait a second here. Let's look at the explanatory power of these two particular worldviews. And how does life, personhood, minds, reason, information, and codes, what is the explanation? And maybe I might want to share, well, if you think extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, I think the evidence is not extraordinary for naturalism. You know, whatever you think of how things are to be explained, if there is an infinite being that has life and is superpersonal and therefore is an infinite mind and knows all things and has all reason and information and thinks in terms of a coherent inner code, I mean, I think that these profound qualities, if they are to arise, I think it's more reasonable to conclude that the cause had all of those qualities exponentially.
You know, there's kind of a parallel that you can draw here between these two different worldviews. In each case, each worldview is postulating the existence of some eternal transcendent reality. In the case of the theist, the transcendent eternal reality is God, a personal God. In the case of the naturalist, his eternal reality is the multiverse, is the potential existence of these infinite number of other universes out there that overcomes the improbability of the existence of life and existence of personality and rationality and all of these things. But what is missing, it seems to me, in that explanation, in the naturalistic explanations of a multiverse, is that yes, it overcomes the improbability of some of these things, but it still doesn't give you a mechanism for how these things came into being.
Again, a reason why I wanted to do this program and why I have written about this in a couple of my books is, again, if I can bring us back to that abductive model, you know, scientists, philosophers call it inference to the best explanation, you know, where we, as human beings, we seem to be beings that look for explanation. And, you know, as again, as I think about cause and effect, as I think about the ground and the source, well, if I encounter life and it's personal and it's mindful and it's rational and it has information and can make use of codes, if that is to be traced back to a source or a ground, it seems much more reasonable to conclude that there must have been a source of all of that that had those qualities.
Right.
And when I engage in naturalism, Dave, I wonder if I'm being given extraordinary claims that are not followed up by extraordinary evidence. I wonder if I'm being given a story. I'm being given an explanatory model, I guess. But what kinds of evidence? I mean, let's put the two models side by side, naturalism and theism, and again, relating to life, personhood, minds, reason, information, and code. I mean, which is more extraordinary, that life, personhood, minds, reason, information, and code came from something that lacked all of those qualities, or came from something that possessed all those qualities in magnitude? And that's kind of a thought experiment, right? I mean, we're kind of asking. I often give the example that, you know, maybe you're sleeping in on Saturday morning, kind of groggy, you start to wake up, you peek through the blinds to see what kind of day it's going to be, you look out and the streets are wet, and you immediately think, well, it must have rained. You know, it seems that human beings are explanation seeking creatures. And you know, that's a high level of rational thought, but you know, I wonder, and again, I'll simply start to close here, wrap up our program by saying, Dave, is this maybe a possible way of responding to that mantra that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence? And is this a possible way of kind of maybe sitting down with our naturalist friends and saying, which one has the more plausible explanatory power?
I think it's very powerful.
Well, let me tell people how they can get more information about this. I wrote a book that came out in 2004. It's entitled "Without a Doubt: Answering the 20 Toughest Faith Questions." I will tell you, I do have doubts, so I'm kind of a hypocrite here. I wrote a book without a doubt, and yet I have doubts. Of course, I think all thinking people have doubts. I wonder, and sometimes I'll ask my atheist friends, do you ever doubt your atheism? Do you ever doubt your skepticism? Or is it only religious people that have doubts? Well, in my book, Without a Doubt, in chapter one, which is entitled, How Can Anyone Know That God Exists? On page 25, I have a table one that compares a naturalist atheist model with a biblical theistic model. And at least some, I think all the things we've talked about are there. And then I've added other issues like morality, truth. And so if you'd like to see that, you can again go to my book, Without a Doubt. And Dave, I talk a little bit about this as well in a couple chapters of my book, Seven Truths that Changed the World. And then, of course, if you can just go on the web and you will, you know, type in extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And there are philosophers who, you know, who have thought about that and give various opinions. But I'm hoping our listeners might want to think about this and reflect upon it. And I wonder if it might be a real source for getting people to kind of focus on who has the best explanatory worldview.
Very good.
Well, let me tell everybody that you, of course, have been listening to Straight Thinking. It's a program that is produced by Reasons to Believe. And we usually have three peas in a pod. Our moderator, our host, Joe Aguirre, has been away for a couple of weeks. We look forward to him coming back. And I hope you'll continue to listen to our program, Straight Thinking. And may the Lord bless you until we meet again. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.